I'm Lawrence K. Jackson, the host of San Diego News Now, KPBS's daily news podcast. Today, we're highlighting the work of one of the station's podcast pioneers. I'm talking about none other than film critic and journalist Beth Accomando, who was the first person to develop a podcast at KPBS, helping us to bridge some long-form film criticism and pair it with some pop culture storytelling and present it to audiences. And this was actually before podcasting became mainstream. She's also behind the station's first ever video podcast. This hours-long feature extends highlights and conversations from two of her shows, Cinema Junkie and Stripper Energy, along with a look at the creative process behind both of them. This is Best of KPBS Podcasts. I'm Lawrence K. Jackson, and this is Best of KPBS Podcasts. Cinema Junkie is hosted by KPBS film critic Beth Accomando. The show dives deep into film culture and explores everything from classic cinema and genre films to conversations with filmmakers, critics, and artists alike. Cinema Junkie focuses on the stories behind the films and the people who make them, offering listeners a deeper appreciation of how movies shape culture and storytelling. I spoke with Beth to take you behind the scenes of the podcast. Please note that this episode of Best of KPBS Podcast contains strong language and discussion that some listeners may find upsetting. Listener discretion is advised. Hey, Beth, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good, good, good. I'm so excited to learn more about Cinema Junkie. I feel like I'm in class today. This is really exciting. You were the first person to develop a podcast here at KPBS. What even first attracted you to podcasting as a way to talk about film, which obviously is video based? And, you know, talk to us about just doing the podcast audio version of Cinema Junkie.
Sure. So, you know, in news, we tend to have very short pieces. So, you know, I was doing minute to 4 minute pieces, maybe a segment, you know, talk segment. But I had early on, I had all these long interviews with filmmakers and artists and writers, and I was using like 2-3 minutes of it. And I'm going like, there's so much more in this that I want people to hear. And podcasting exploded at a certain time. Serial on NPR was one of the things that really opened people's eyes to the ability to use a different format. And so I just said, this is kind of the Wild West, and can I just take a lot of these old interviews I have and repackage them? Because film is evergreen. You know, the film may have come out a year ago or it might be brand new, but people are always interested in movies. So I was able to kind of dig back. I was doing features for NPR at the time, especially a lot of them on Hong Kong cinema, and I had access to these people that weren't getting showcased elsewhere. So I just felt like it was a perfect thing to do. And amazingly, they just let me. So it was like a kid in a candy store. Like, yes, I can talk about all these things I love. So, yeah, I just love movies. I love talking about them. And I wanted to share an early one. And this is with Ian McKellen, who was in our old KPBS studios. And, you know, I was instructed, make sure you say Sir Ian. He came in a big limo onto the campus. And we sat in this old studio. And during one of the answers, he casually kind of leaned back and put his elbow on the baffling, the sound baffling that was there. And the whole thing fell off the wall. And he was so gracious, he just, without even saying anything, pushed it back up and just continued with the interview. And so this was back in 1995, and I was interviewing him about his role in Richard III, a new film adaptation at that time.
It's been one crash course in how to make movies for me. And Richard Longcrane, the director, who was extremely suspicious of Shakespeare, was always pulling, as we were preparing the production, to saying, we're making a movie, Ian, we're making a movie. And I was always saying to him, yes, please make a movie, please make a movie. But wait a minute here, I think Shakespeare can help you here. everything there springs out of Shakespeare. So I was allowed to be in on the whole planning of the way the movie would look. I was involved with the casting of it. And the actual filming of it, I was able to make suggestions when it was being cut together. And yes, the sound was of great interest to me because It is a talkie, and I do want the audience to listen. And the opening 10 minutes gradually leads them into the idea that they're going to be invited to listen eventually, as we give the exposition of the events which lead up to the beginning of our story. We see the end of the Civil War. It begins very quietly. No words are spoken. Tap of a Morse code. It's the whine of a dog. It's the scrape of a knife and fork on a plate as Richard's first victim has his last supper. And then a dog starts barking, and in comes Richard III riding on a tank. Well, dogs bark at me as I pass by them. I mean, that was the reason, you know, directly from the text, that's why that happened. And then the sound continues, and we hear Richard's heavy breathing through the gas mask he's wearing. And I'm breathing in the rhythm of blank verse, whether you know it or not, di-dum, 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 and then I shoot my second victim, and the movie starts, and then you see Richard go across the screen, RICHARD111, and that's the first word that has an impact, and it's the word that Shakespeare gave as the title. Then we hear some music, and then there's a song. Oh, so those are the first words, are they? Yes, the song, and the song is written, unfortunately, not by Shakespeare. I went right through the canon. I couldn't find anything that I really approved of. So it's Come Live With Me and Be My Love, words by Christopher Marlowe. But when they were first published, actually, were published under Shakespeare's name. And did you notice that the big band playing behind was William Shakespeare's band? He had his initials on the each of the bandstands, WS band. And then you see the dance, you see the crowd celebrating, and then Richard, as the successful commander-in-chief, steps up onto the platform, and the singer goes, and through a microphone, we hear the first public words, "Now is the winter of our discontent." And I hope the audience by that time wants somebody to be speaking, is pleased if they know the play to realize, it is the first words of the play. And for those who don't know the play, because of the prologue and the lead up to it, they can actually understand what Richard is talking about and what events he's referring to. And that really kickstarts the film in a way that the play often doesn't do. I think it takes a long time for people to get into Richard III on stage. But in this movie, they're there right from the word go, hopefully.
I love that. And apologies throughout this interview, because every time you say a professional actor's name, I'm like, oh, that's Magneto. Oh, okay. I'm like, I know exactly who that is. I know they're thespians. I know, you know, I love listening to the interviews where they talk about how they never expected to do Marvel movies. And now when they're on the street, that's usually like the top thing they hear. But to know, you know, how much pride they take in their art. You know, I know Sir McKellen has much longer credentials and critiques that he'll get credited for, but I know him affectionately as Magneto. So
and Gandalf.
Exactly. I'm excited for that. An icon for sure, a giant.
Yes.
Beth, Cinema Junkie often goes, you know, beyond just the surface. I know you pride yourself on digging deeper and into these conversations. What are some of the ways you've chosen to look at film?
Sure. I really like to present films in some sort of context. And that context can be within film history. Where does this fit? How did it innovate? What was it playing off of? Or in a social context, like how did this film reflect what was going on in the world? How did this film change what was going on? And I've always felt that film is a gateway to understanding broader topics and other issues, and especially other points of views. It's just, you know, it's very accessible, and also it's not scary to people. Picking up a book sometimes, or, you know, going to a Shakespeare play or things like that can be a little intimidating, but like everyone goes to the movies and they're entertaining. So, you know, I've tackled things like tactical frivolity, which is how can you use humor and satire to affect political change and be a form of protest. During the pandemic, I talked to an epidemiologist who used the film Contagion as a teaching tool to say, like, here's a classic example of what you should be doing. I also love zombies and neuroscience, and we've talked about the, you know, zombies may have no brains, but they have big hearts. So they sometimes are great vehicles for social messaging. And there are neuroscientists who use zombies in their classes. So, like, these are ways that I want to try to excite people about film. So I'll talk to filmmakers, I'll talk to artists, but I also love what academics and scientists can bring, and also, you know, just nerdy people. So one of my favorite guests, and I've had him introduce an entire year of Godzilla films at Digital Gym Cinema, and this is Remy Tadaishi. So he's both an academic and a total nerd, and he loves Godzilla. He teaches about Godzilla and Japanese sci-fi. And we spoke about Godzilla, but in the context of how is the monster the message? And this is especially in the first film, Gojira, from back in the 1950s. This Japanese Gojira film had this sense of the horrors of having a nuclear bomb dropped on you.
Yeah, there are scenes and shots that are just done very starkly, almost documentary-like, just focusing on, yeah, the carnage and just the devastation. There are scenes that echo what, you know, firsthand eyewitness accounts of the bomb going off was like. There are scenes like that in the film. Most notably, there's the scene where Godzilla fires his breath on the street, and you just see this big wind sweeping down the street, and then this big burst of light. And that's what firsthand accounts of the bomb going off is like. You saw a big wind sweeping everything away, and then a big flash of light. Scenes like that had that allegorical dimension, definitely.
I love learning about the different types of films. You know, I wouldn't be so familiar if it wasn't for you into the different types of Japanese films. I love the historical overlay of it, where we talk about the metaphors in it. So I love that. Talk to me. I also appreciate the differentiation between academics and nerds, you know, because they're both smart. They're both intelligent people. But I like that nerds kind of pride themselves on taking it to that next level voluntarily, completely voluntarily. Like, no one made me do this. I don't have a deadline. I'm doing this for pure sport and fun. Talk to me about this quiz. There's a quiz.
Yes. Well, because Remy is also a nerd, I decided that since I had this cool CD of sound effects, I would give him a little quiz. I want to play a little round of Stump the Professor. It's not very often you can get a professor into a public radio station who teaches about Godzilla. I have this CD that has sound effects from the Godzilla movies. So I want to play a cut of sounds from some of these monsters, and you out there listening can do your best to see if you can identify which monster these are from. But I'm going to play these and see how fast Remy can tell us who these creatures are. So first off, let's play this one.
Those are the cries of Mothra, who is one of my favorite, probably if I had to name a favorite monster, it would be Mothra of all of the Toho pantheon of monsters. Mothra is my favorite because it's the most limited in movement with just these two wings that flap. And so you really see the ingenuity of the creative team in placing this creature with very limited movement into these fight scenes. How do you make that visually interesting for, you know, these 10-minute climactic fight scenes at the end of a movie? So, yeah, I think for that reason, Mothra is probably my favorite monster.
Mothra, yeah, Mothra, dongan kasaku ya indomu.
All right, so Remy's one for one.
Those are the chirps of King Ghidra's heads, the monster who was created in 1964. And I love those because it sounds like just like someone twiddling on an organ. But they tweak those sounds, and I think it sounds great for something that's just really alien-sounding, which, you know, Ghidra's this giant space dragon. So, yeah, they did a great job with that. It's a very 60s-sounding organ, I think.
Well, and Ghidra is also one of the first more kind of overtly political creatures, because the three-headed dragon represented China.
Yeah, coming around in 1964, which was the first bomb test in China.
Seems like it's very difficult to stump you. Let's try one last one.
Uh, Okay, as a professor, I give myself an F if I didn't get that one, which is the roar of the original 1954 Godzilla. And that's just a defining sound effect, not just in Japanese monster films, but I think just in general in science fiction and horror film.
And can you give us a little background on what that sound was?
Well, so there's differing accounts, but what they have in common is that it was the rubbing up and down by a leather glove or possibly a key or, you know, some friction-causing object on a contrabass string, rubbing up and down and then manipulating the tape speed. That's how they got that sound effect. And interestingly enough, a similar technique was used to create the sound of Doctor Who's TARDIS, if you listen to that sound effect.
Amazing, amazing. I think what I love more than the quiz, even though the quiz is super, super cool, I love when they explain how they made the sounds, you know, because we're talking about sounds from the 60s.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how did they come up with this? So to think of gloves or even anything like that, coming up with dinosaur and Mothra sounds is super, super cool. That was a quiz with a professor, which is only on the list of people you've spoken with. You've spoken with filmmakers, historians, critics, and more from around the world. Mm-hmm. What makes for a great film conversation, Beth?
I really think passion is key. If the person I'm talking to doesn't care all that much about making movies, then I'm not going to be able to have much of a conversation with them. So, you know, people who are making films just to make money or casually for some reason but don't love it, like, I don't know. It's hard to get a conversation out of that. I feel like the people who live and breathe film are just great to talk to. And I really appreciate also diverse perspectives and voices that aren't always heard. I want to hear from the fringes, not just from the Hollywood mainstream, because personally, the stuff that's being made out on the fringes or in genre filmmaking is the most interesting and most fun. And then, of course, too, it's knowledge and skills. Like, am I talking to people who are the best in their craft or people who are innovating or something like that? And I like to do something I call crew call, where I try to highlight a different profession or job so that people can appreciate how films are made, things you may not know that much about. And because I'm an action film junkie, I, of course, wanted to highlight stunt work. And I'm proud to say that finally stunt work is going to become an Oscar category, I think, in 2027. But I had the opportunity to talk with Chad Stahelski. He's the director of the John Wick films, but he was also a former stuntman and the co-founder of 8711 Action Design. And I wanted him to give a little bit of insight into what stunt work is like and especially for, like, how do you make a film like John Wick, which really feels like it's raising the bar on action cinema?
Our company, 8711, deals with something called action design. There's stunt coordinating, there's stunt choreography, there's action choreography, which is choreographing the moves much like a dance sequence or a musical. And then there's the orchestration of the stunts, which most stunt coordinators do. And then there's action design. Action design goes to the next level of, while you're in the script and prep phase, how is this sequence going to be executed? How is it going to look? How is it going to be designed? And when we did the first John Wick, we kind of executed what we've always wanted to do in film. And I think in Hollywood, style, tone, like, you know, the mise-en-scène of every project comes to fruition in the dialogue scenes and the photography and the lighting. Very rarely does it come together with action sequences. We want you to learn something from the character. We want you to appreciate the tone. And we want you to see the action. So yes, we like wider shots. We like seeing real professionals, whether there are acting performers or stunt performers, execute the choreography or the stunts that we want you to see. There are a few exceptions to what I'm going to say, but nowadays, action is looked at as the execution only, because they don't want to spend the money on prep or they want to spend the time shooting it. The first thing that gets crunched in budget wars, which everyone has to go through, is either prep or days to shoot. So a lot of times you get an action sequence that's shot and executed, not so much to show things, but to hide things or hide imperfections. If the cast member hasn't had enough time to train, you'll shoot him tighter. You won't see as much because you don't want to see the imperfections of technique or choreography. If you use a stunt double, you're going to want to hide the double, so you're doing a lot of over the shoulders or super wide shots or super tight shots. You're trying to hide things. If you don't have the time, if the guns don't work or the weapons don't work or the car doesn't start or you can't go fast enough, it's more about hiding and not showing the audience as opposed to a lot of prep. Great professionals executing at a very high level that have been thoroughly rehearsed. And I mean rehearsed with the camera teams. the actual on-camera performers. Your cinematographer has lit a way that will entice you, not just aesthetically, but the lights will be hidden so you can shoot wide shots. Pretty much the whole crew is in on the action. Mm-hmm. Pretty much just how the rest of Hollywood does dialogue scenes. I don't know why they just, you know, throw it to the wind when it comes to action sequences. We just put the same care into our action scenes that we try to put into our acting or our dialogue scenes. It's not hard. It's the same process most directors use for all their other scenes. For some reason, it just doesn't translate to action. I don't know. It's always a mystery to us.
It seems like, too, from Asian action films, that they do value the time put into mm-hmm. that stunt work. And is that something that you also got when you worked with Yuen Woo Ping on The Matrix? Is that something kind of you got to see on a Hollywood film? And did that inspire you in any way?
What we really liked about working with Yuen Woo Ping was the methodology behind his action. The amount it was rehearsed, the amount of training that went into the cast. Most stunt teams rehearse a great deal with stunt doubles and the stuntmen, and a little bit with the actors. We throw every penny we can into training the cast member. And we just don't train them to memorize moves. Keanu was trained on this one to be a practical three-gun firearm technician, as well as trained with SWAT and military personnel, and then brought to the choreography teams to accentuate that. Our best judo and jiu-jitsu martial art people were used to train them. So rather than fake being good, we just trained Keanu to be good. Basically, we just trained him to be a stunt guy. We got that from very much the Hong Kong thing because it allows you to shoot differently. If your cast member is just a rock star and can do all the choreography that we want, you don't have to cut, or you can choose where the cut goes. It's more of a directorial edit to give you pacing or to give you emotion or to give you some kind of storytelling ability, as opposed to our actors only trained to do three moves at a time, which forces the edit, or I have to use a stunt double, which forces the angle, or I can't see because the other stunt guys haven't been trained, or the cameraman hasn't been on rehearsal, so the cameraman's got an 80-pound camera on his shoulder trying to keep up with all the gun. It always comes through, again, trying to hide what's not there. The Hong Kong teams, their cameramen were ex-stunt guys. Their editors were stunt, like, mm-hmm. from the editor to the director to the performers, that link or that production line was all on the same page. They were all at rehearsals. They were all there.
Stunt work will finally be an Oscar category, and you really helped us understand why there, Beth. I mean, I think it's super cool at the end of hit movies where we have guys jumping out of planes and doing triple backflips when they take the picture with their stunt double and they're like the same height with the same color hair. You know, yours would have like red hair and be wearing like a green shirt and be like, this is best stunt double. I just think it's cool because it gives acknowledgement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you through that interview really helped us understand, if people didn't know already, how much work, physical mm-hmm. testing and, you know, they... I like the part where he says, instead of just bringing in someone that's Keanu's stunt, we just focused on Keanu. We just taught him how to fight better and how to mechanic better. So I thought that was really, really cool. Insightful stuff. Stunt doubles. I mean, who doesn't like that? I think those are, you know, some of the coolest behind the scenes, quote unquote, parts of movies. So thank you for letting us into that world a little bit as well. Beth, what do you hope listeners take away from the show? You've been doing it a lot of interviews for a long time now. What are some goals? Some of the goals you started out with, and then some forward-thinking goals. What do you want listeners to take away from the show?
You know, I really want people to. I want my passion to inspire people to go see movies. Get off your butt. Get off your couch. Go to a cinema. See a movie. Especially at places like Digital Gym, where not only are you watching the movie, but there's a good chance afterwards you might talk to other people who love movies as well. I feel like it's something that it needs to be a discussion. It needs to be a community event. So that's what I hope. I hope people will seek out some of the obscure films that I talk about and not just go like, I hope they put it on a list and go like, wow, that sounds really crazy. I'm going to try and find that. So I just want my love of cinema to inspire other people and to keep a vibrant cinema culture alive here in San Diego. I try to do that through the podcast and also through Film Geek San Diego, where I volunteer program for Digital Gym and also at Comic-Con Museum some events. It's just, you know, I love movies and I love sharing them with people. I often do themed food for the film screenings that I do, and then discussion, and then bringing in other people to introduce the films, whether they're filmmakers who are a part of it or academics. It's all about just enjoying it and elevating it a little bit, just saying like, hey, it's not something you go see and then you say like, oh, what do you want to have for dinner? It's like, You watch it and you're like, wow, those effects, those stunts, that acting, that idea. I've never seen anything like that before. I mean, I just saw I Love Boosters, and you walk out of that going like, man, there isn't another movie like that anywhere. It's amazing. And you want to talk to somebody about it.
Yes. No, I absolutely love that. I understand your cinema junkiness. And listening to you now, it's almost like instead of just watching the movie and going home, we want you to discuss it. We want to have a conversation around it. You're almost building that online community that I could name drop some social media sites in person. You're like, come in person. We could discuss after. We can discuss some shots. Maybe there's a director. Maybe there's a stunt double. You know, you kind of get to know the ins and outs and the intricacy of movies. So thank you so much, Beth. And I think that passion pops. It pops through the microphone and it pops on screen when you're there. Beth Alcamondo with us from Cinema Junkie. Thank you so much for your time, Beth.
Oh, thank you.
That was my conversation with Beth Alcamondo about her podcast, Cinema Junkie. You can find Cinema Junkie wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll be back after the break to talk about Beth's other project, Stripper Energy. I'm Lawrence K. Jackson, and this is the Best of KPBS Podcasts. Our next featured podcast also comes from Beth Alcamondo, but it explores storytelling in a very different way. Stripper Energy is a video podcast focused on the historic Lay Girls Theater. The podcast uses archival material to reveal a dark chapter in San Diego history. Stripper Energy is also the first video podcast produced at KPBS, expanding the station's approach to digital storytelling. I spoke with Beth about how this project came together. Now, Beth, so excited to still have you here with us. I wanted to start with, how would you even describe Stripper Energy? Let's start there.
Well, it took me a while to craft something to go in the description for the podcast. So I did say, prepare for sassy strippers, corrupt cops, and a fierce activism launched from the unlikely stage of a strip club. And that's sort of what it is. I mean, what appealed to me about this story is that it was from the fringes. Just like I love movies that are outside of mainstream Hollywood, I feel like a strip club and strippers, dancers, are not something that the mainstream media often focuses on. And even when you're talking about activism and civil rights and things like that, you know, the civil rights of sex workers or of dancers is not necessarily what gets the front pages. So this was really a story about fighting back from the fringes, kind of the fringes of the fringes. These are marginalized people within a marginalized group. And the key message in it is really this idea of not being a silent bystander. It's this sense of if you see something that's going on that's not right, you should speak up. And sometimes that means speaking up when it's dangerous. Sometimes it means speaking up when you're afraid. But this sense of you can't rely on other people to necessarily save you or help you. So you have to stand up for yourself, and you have to stand up for those people around you that you see who maybe aren't standing up for themselves. And so the person it's about, Cotta Pierce Morgan, also is a very strong advocate of this idea that art can heal. She went through a lot of trauma, but she never paints herself as a victim. And her story is surprisingly like inspirational and hopeful despite a lot of very dark things. But part of that is this sense of art is really a place where there's hope and where there's healing. And so even though it takes us to some dark places, Kata has a very like positive and optimistic outlook about life and about how you can recover from things like that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, as you mentioned, the inspiration for this project is Kata Pierce Morgan, a former dancer and owner of Lay Girls Theater. Talk to me about when this project came about. You're the arts reporter, but by doing this form of storytelling, you're doing a lot of news reporting and news content. So talk to me about that overlap a little bit, Beth.
Sure. So I met Kata by covering the Fringe Festival, San Diego International Fringe Festival. And this is a celebration of kind of uncensored creativity in theater. And Kata would have a show every year on what's called the Fringes of the Fringe at Lay Girls Theater, which is the strip club. And early on, it was hard for her to get people to come because people were not sure what to expect. Like, are we seeing a strip club show? Are we seeing theater? But every time I interviewed her about her shows, she would reveal something about how, well, this show takes part of my past about this dancer who committed suicide because of police harassment, or, oh, this is about the time when, you know, whatever. And I would get all these little tidbits of information, like little breadcrumbs. And finally, I was just like, Kata, we need to like sit down and talk about some of this backstory, some of the history of Les Girls Theater. And when KPBS had this opportunity to do a digital fellowship, I pitched the idea. And I have to say, I was a little surprised that they actually accepted it. Part of my brain was going like, yeah, they'll never take something about stripper energy. But her story was really fascinating because she was somebody who started as a dancer in the early 70s, witnessed police corruption, harassment by the cops, especially the vice cops, and decided that she wasn't going to take it and that she was going to fight back. And like you mentioned about the archival material, she had tons of archival material. So here's a clip from the first episode, and it introduces the trio of strippers that I spoke to for the podcast. From the turbulent 1960s with its civil rights struggle, Cold War, and generation gap.
My name, Bobby Boobay, because they were calling me Bobby Booby, and I said, no, this is Les Girls. I have to be Bobby Boobay.
Then, from the 1970s with Watergate, hippies, and the rise of feminism.
Hi, I'm Kata Pierce Morgan. They know me as Kathleen or Kathy. It depends on what venue I'm in.
And then from the 1980s with Ronald Reagan, home computers, and tabloid talk shows.
You know, I used multiple names when I was dancing. I used Tia, I used Pepper, I used Raina.
All three danced at Les Girls Theater in San Diego, a venue that opened in 1968.
When you look around, you know, the stage is the same as it was. It's exactly the same.
My first impression was that I felt like I had landed on another planet. I'd had no experience with that kind of atmosphere. So coming from this Catholic background, I was so surprised and shocked. And I wouldn't say it was scary. I'd say I was dumbfounded, and I didn't quite know how to take it. And this was a circuit. It was Les Girls, Showplace, the bedroom, and the naughty spot. And there was a pink car, and it drove us from one club to the other. And there are generally three strippers in the car with the chauffeur.
At that time, I was just dancing topless and making pretty good money because I needed to take care of my three children. So what do? You work at night, and you take care of your kids in the daytime.
I came to dancing out of necessity. My boyfriend and I ran out of money. I didn't really have any job skills. I didn't know how to waitress. It wasn't anything I was even inclined to learn how to do. And then I saw the ad for dancing, and I'm like, I think I could do that. We had to audition. Thank goodness I had some sense of rhythm, and I didn't really have dancer clothes. I had some lingerie. I had a trim figure, and they hired me.
They did not know what to do with me. I remember the awkwardness of it because I was a trained ballerina. I wasn't very sexy. They tried to edge me up. So at Les Girls, they showed porn movies. And so I had porn splashing on my body. You know, I'm pretty sure on my back I had people, you know, having sex.
I loved the being up on stage, getting under the lights, dancing, the physicality, the art of it, and the costumes.
So the first gown that I had was an all-sequence long gown. And basically, it was just a regular gown. So I put the breakaway zipper in the back.
Oh my gosh, I loved the theatrical costumes and the art of removing a costume in a certain way.
You know, you kind of came on stage and you walked around. And you had gloves, and so you take your gloves off and you know, drop them.
Then you can look over your shoulder and be flirty about the way you take the costume off.
Reached back and unzipped your breakaway gown, and when it came off, the audience gasped.
That is fun.
You can do things suggestively. So when you move the boa and it falls, it's touching your body as it goes down to your arm. It's a hand caressing you. So there was a lot of things to take off, with the exception of pasties. At that time, we had to wear pasties and a G-string. I did a show where I got the guys out of the audience. Come on up here. I'm going to show you how to bounce your boobs. So, you know, put your hands up here like this, and you do this. Okay, so you'd see these guys. Oh. And I had a little skit that went along with it. Well, this is Mo, this is Joe, and I got my mojo working.
If you can meet somebody's eye and really smile at them, you can reach somebody at a deeper level. Yeah, there's people may look at you and objectify you in a certain way, but if you can meet somebody's eye and really smile at them, you touch them in a way that's different. People remember that.
I love that, Beth. I love that. I love hearing from former strippers, and I know you mentioned that a lot of this was built from archival footage, mm-hmm. but stripping in itself is a bit visual, right? So with it being a video, our first video podcast at KPBS, I think makes sense. Talk to me. I know this first episode, you know, has a light, breezier tone, but the story does get a little sharper mm-hmm. and darker. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah. And while we were hearing them talk about stripping, it is really fun to see Bobby at like 88 talking about her strip routine, which was amazing. But yeah, so, you know, I wanted to introduce you to this world, and that first introduction, I didn't want it to be like, oh, all this is dark. A lot of these women enjoyed the stripping. They had to do it for money. But it wasn't a horrible thing for them, just the job itself. But what became horrible was the fact that they ended up being harassed by the cops. And it's kind of a long story because it involves Cotta's husband, who was deliberately sort of poking the beast and challenging the city on a lot of things. And so they were harassing him through the strip club by, you know, arresting dancers. Frequently they got arrested, but no charges were ever filed. Nobody ever got convicted. But Cotta managed to remain remarkably positive and optimistic, even though all this was going down for years. This wasn't something that was they were being harassed for a few months. This was years, even decades of things. And mainly they were being harassed by the vice cops. And here Cotta explains that kind of after a lot of this had happened, she discovered that the cops had been referring to the dancers as NHIs, which was no humans involved. And her discovery of this kind of really made her reevaluate and look back on those things in a slightly different light.
That societal attitude allowed police to think that certain murders, assaults, and disappearances could be treated differently and even ignored if the victims fit the category of NHI, or no humans involved.
They're talking about the fringe women, and that being a exotic dancer, we were lumped right in with the hookers and the drug addicts and the biker gang women.
Wow. That's very interesting. I did not know that strippers had been put into that category. That's really sad, because what it does is it's demoralizing, and it takes us down to the level of animal. They're not even thinking of us as being human beings, as less than humans. That's really sad.
Actually, it's a godsend. It's giving me clarity as to why they treated us the way they did. And I think about the cops, the different cops, you know, the things that they did to us, and they did it without accountability. And for once, I'm starting to see it. I never understood it. I never understood how they could be like that. I thought they were just, you know, and just, but in truth, they were living this code that the police had, that society had. And that's why they felt they were condoned to do the things that they did, even having threats with us and sex with us and arrests with us. And they thought we were not human and we could be treated that way.
But what cops and society in general didn't count on was stripper energy.
I didn't know I had stripper energy. Absolutely, I was energetic. I was sassy. I was feisty.
That energy has been in me, I think, my whole life. And it's funny because I have used that energy in other areas of my life, and it's come out with a ferociousness. And my daughter has called me a dragon mama.
I'm this tough young woman, you know. I'll punch you in the nose. And I did.
I'm not afraid anymore. It's not that I shouldn't be afraid. I'm just not, because no one's coming to save me. I've got to save myself.
And I think that real courage, you know, as I became an activist, is going into very scary, fearful situations where you're taking on authorities and you're telling the public what it was really like. And you have to be afraid, you know, I mean, you have to be afraid because of retaliation, and we'll be talking more about that later. But I did it anyway, and I think that's what courage is when you do it even though you're scared.
So, as we mentioned, there were a lot of archival materials, and one of the things I asked Kata was, don't go into these archival materials and revisit them before I get there. I'd kind of like to see your reaction to them 50 years later and how it felt. And so she did open up some documents. She found some journals that she literally had not seen in 50 years. And I asked her to read from some of them to kind of give us a sense of what she was going through at the time. And it turned out to be a little difficult for her to read some of these journal entries, especially when she was writing about this vice cop that she was having sex with in order to avoid harassment and constant arrests. And so this is her looking at a journal that she hadn't seen in 50 years.
Here's something I wrote back during the time period, probably end of 70s, I wrote this. And it was before I became a political activist, which was 83, 84. So I'll see if I can get through this, because it's, I wrote it with some emotion at the time, and I certainly was reliving and remembering a lot of things. So my name is Kathleen Pierce. In 1976, I was manager at Showplace. Previous to that, I had worked for several years as a dancer after graduating from college. While managing Showplace Theater, I had a sexual relationship with a vice squad officer. In retrospect, I see how damaging it was for me. If I had to do it again, I would have done the same thing again. To understand this, I have to explain my sexual and emotional history and the dynamics that takes place between a vulnerable dancer and a powerful vice officer. I found beauty in my life through dance. Although I was dancing nude, I was more involved with the costuming, the choreography, and the pure joy of movement, that I was still untouched by the eroticism of my work. I was a very skilled dancer on stage. I was very familiar with false reports. I knew that I had no rights. In my 3 years of managing, however, I was never arrested, although others were, because I had the protection of a vice officer. And at some point, I no longer had sex with the vice officer, although I can't remember when it ended. It had lasted about a year, I believe. I'm now mentally healthy and have accomplished a lot academically and professionally. I have no desire to relive those years that I have now shared, but I must defend the dancer's right to make their own choice with whom they have sex. Coercive sex, no matter how willing the victim is, because she fears... I can't read anymore, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Kata getting choked up there. I would love to revisit the no humans involved. You know, it was used to classify... Mm-hmm. marginalized people, people of color, people who were drug addicts, people who danced or sold their bodies. And it was kind of used as a way to justify, like, this person was less than human.
Yes.
Which, of mm-hmm. course, historically, I mean, we could go on and on about the use of that. But I think what it really speaks to is her. I thought what she said that was powerful was, I would do it again, because I was the one not getting arrested constantly. I was getting harassed maybe at a lesser rate. But it was all because she had kind of given herself to this vice cop. And, you know, you go on to talk about a lot of the things that she realizes maybe in retrospect about herself and her experience, if you're able to speak to that more, Beth, about maybe where she is now as a survivor, mm-hmm. And, you know, how it almost propelled her to her next chapter in life.
Yeah, she was a dancer, so she was an artist in that respect, but she was also a poet her whole life. And poetry was something where she could express herself and deal with these traumatic emotions. And so the poetry eventually led to other forms of art, and she fought back not only through her art, but also, you know, she did make a stand. Aside from the art, but she was filing complaints. She was going to Internal Affairs. She was going to the media. She was trying to change laws, which she successfully did on some accounts. But after she kind of won some of these battles and became a little bit more removed from that political struggle, she turned to art as a way of healing and as a way of also still dealing with those topics. A lot of the issues that came up during this time surface in her shows in different ways, some very powerfully about a dancer or about suicide or about raids on you know, a strip club. But she mainly works through the International Fringe Festival. She creates a different show every year. She skipped last year because she was actually building an additional theater for the Fringe Festival to use. But, you know, at this particular moment in time when we're seeing arts funding being cut and, you know, the arts seeming to be devalued, it's really important to remember just how powerful art can be to the creator and also to those who witness the art. I mean, what Kata went through is something that other people can identify with. And so I did speak to her about, you know, the term fringe women came up in No Humans Involved, but it also can refer to these female artists at the Fringe Festival who choose to tackle topics that aren't being dealt with elsewhere. So here she's talking a little bit about her fringe work.
I think what it is we take the risk. And we are on the fringe. In fact, when I get awards sometimes, they give me the Fringe of the Fringe Award. I mean, we were really out there.
Out there on the fringes of the fringe is where I first met Kata and became intrigued by her story. What Kata loves about Fringe is that she can take advantage of BYOV, or bring your own venue. That allows her to put Les Girls Theater at the center of her art, sharing its history and celebrating the positives that emerged from all the trauma.
And what was present at that time was the high heel footprint, the stripper energy, all that past. You could hear them clunk, 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 walking across the stage. And now Golden Corpse presents a bigger footprint.
Golden Corpse is the name Kata gave to her theater company.
I labeled us hashtag not a silent bystander. I always looked at us as speaking out. And we present social injustice shows about what happened around Les Girls in San Diego, and its seedy streets and its amazing stages and all the performers that are haunting the walls now, because we go back 50 years.
For her 2024 Fringe show, No Regrets, Kata drew on everything from vaudeville to Italian giallo to science fiction in order to view a seminal event in Les Girls' history. The night in 1968 that Kata's late husband James Morgan suffered a humiliating raid at the hands of San Diego Vice. It was the night that forever changed the city's adult entertainment landscape and led to the opening of Les Girls Theater.
Beth, as our audience learned in this interview, if they didn't know already, Stripper Energy was our first ever KPBS video podcast. What did you learn from working in the video podcasting space, Beth, as compared to just standard audio?
Well, I think video podcasting is now the new frontier. And, you know, some people still don't understand, like, you're creating something you want people to watch. So, you know, I still had to create an audio version of this, which I really hated doing because there's so much of it that's visual. So people are creating things that are meant to be watched. If you decide to walk away for a little bit or look away from the screen, that's fine. But, you know, if you're hearing something like Bobby Boubé talking about getting her mojo back, maybe you want to look back at the screen. So I just appreciate that it is this kind of new realm, and I want to try and explore it and innovate and just do something that's creative and fresh.
I loved listening to it. I love how it kind of gives us a peek into the times, because mm-hmm. it seems like strippers were much more fancy and it was much more presentation. I've never seen an interactive stripper show. I don't think I've ever seen that. So I think that's pretty iconic. But Beth, thank you so much for making time for us. This is the Best of KPBS Podcast with Beth Accomando. Thank you so much, Beth.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Beth Accomando about Stripper Energy, a video podcast from KPBS. It explores activism from an unlikely stage of a strip club. You can watch and listen to Stripper Energy on KPBS website or wherever you find your podcasts. You've been listening to the Best of KPBS Podcast. Each episode brings you extended excerpts from some of KPBS's most compelling podcasts, along with conversations that take you behind the scenes of the journalism and storytelling that makes these programs possible. Best of KPBS Podcast is a production of the KPBS Audio Department. This episode of Best of KPBS Podcast was produced by Rebecca Chacon. Executive produced and editor is KPBS Director of Audio Programming and Operations, Lisa Jane Morissette, with additional editorial support from senior producer Brooke Ruth and today's guest, arts reporter Beth Accomando. And of course, I'm Lawrence K. Jackson. Thanks for listening and join again for Best of KPBS Podcasts.